Welcome to the Bruin Podcast, What Now for Global Markets? This follows on from a webinar that took place on Wednesday, the 17th of February, with myself and my colleagues Ian Quigley and Daniel Moroney. Ahead of the event, we put out a poll to you guys, our audience, to find out what you were thinking, which really helped form the conversation that we had. And you will notice throughout the podcast that the answers are displayed. We really hope you enjoy the session. And if there's any questions that come out of it, please do just get in touch. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on this bright spring morning. I would like to start by introducing myself, Catherine Flavin, Investment Manager at Bruin, and my colleagues, Ian Quigley, Head of Investment Strategy, and Daniel Moroney, Chair of the Portfolio Construction Committee, who I'll be in conversation with today. Good morning, guys.
Morning. Morning, Catherine.
We are all delighted to see so many people not only joining in this morning, but also taking part in our online poll and for sending in some really thought-provoking questions that we will try to cover throughout our conversation. However, if we don't get to your question, we will contact you after the event. Before we begin the conversation, I would like to give you a short introduction to Bruin to give you a little bit more insight into our resources and capabilities that some of you may not be aware of. Bruin is a publicly listed company on the London Stock Exchange, founded in 1792, with over 50 billion in assets under management. We have 33 offices across the UK, Channel Islands and Ireland. And of the funds under management, over 5 billion is managed here in Ireland. We create personalized investment solutions to meet our clients' needs and objectives. And assets can be anything from savings and pensions to inheritance or proceeds of the sale of a business. Now, to take you to the subject of the day, what now for global markets? In order to make this conversation just a little bit more interesting, we will look at some of the poll responses that you've sent in. And again, guys, thank you so much for taking part in this. It will just give us much more of an insight, I suppose, into what our clients are thinking. And it'll also give you guys a little bit of color as to what people around you are thinking. So I might go into the first question. One of the questions we asked was, do you believe COVID-19 has permanently changed the economy? Let's see the results here. Okay, interesting. Nearly over 65% of you believe it has permanently changed the economy. Ian, I might ask you a question in relation to this. I suppose, do you agree with this? And if so, how do we invest to capture this change?
Thanks, Catherine, and good morning, everybody. First thing I'd like to say is just to thank everyone, all our clients, for your support over the last year. It's immensely valued. Reflecting on the question and indeed looking at the survey, I'd agree. I think it has changed, and notwithstanding, it's been an incredibly challenging time, clearly, for everybody over the last year. From an investment perspective, I would argue, in fact, that it's a really exciting time. We're seeing accelerated adoption of technologies across the economy. We're seeing a clear inflection in certain industries. E-commerce is the obvious one, but as well as people going shopping online, we see digital first businesses now, or businesses that are becoming digital first, like Nike and L'Oreal, selling well-known consumer brands, selling over 25% of their products online now. So it's a really interesting development. And we need to look no further than the Microsoft CEO, Satya Nadella, who remarked very recently he felt that digital transformation had been accelerated by 5 years. That's pretty dramatic. We've been talking about this for a number of years. And by it, I mean the potential for an increase in productivity driven by technological innovation. And we think there's a real chance that that's starting to inflect, and we're going to see that now. Indeed, across multiple industries, the very foundations of our economy, transportation, healthcare, agriculture, materials, energy, we believe that they could all be utterly transformed over the next decade. I think what we've seen over the last year as a consequence of COVID has been an acceleration in that trend. And we're persuaded that over the next decade, we could see some of the biggest economic transformation, and therefore likely political transformation, the world has ever seen, arguably bigger than the Industrial Revolution. So I think to be very mindful of that in terms of how we construct portfolios, it's important. There'd be loads of opportunity, loads of risk, of course, One of the key questions we get and you asked is, how do we capture this? I think that's a great question. It's one thing being able to see it happening and to suggest it may accelerate, but how do we capture it? Difficult. How I would answer that is to say, well, we effectively and essentially adopt a three-pronged approach. The first being defense. I think it's the first thing, the more obvious thing, the easier thing to do is to avoid industries or businesses that we don't think are going to get through this change. We can see the disparate performance within equity markets over the last year. Just compare the performance of, say, the FTSE 100 versus the NASDAQ, for example, and we can see that certain industries, banks, shopping centers, industries that are more in the analog era rather than the digital era, they're struggling to adapt to this change and trying to kind of avoid those sectors or businesses that may be vulnerable. Then also to think proactively, the second approach would be to think proactively about what incumbent businesses, what businesses that people have great familiarity with that can actually prosper and can adjust their business models for increased digitalization. And Nike and L'Oreal are two examples of that. And then lastly, how else can we capture? I think because the change is likely to be so seismic, I think it's incumbent on us to think about how we invest in businesses that are going to create and capture new markets. That's much more difficult. They're harder to value businesses. In some instances, there are companies that are not free cash flow positive, but are just exhibiting very strong revenue growth. How do we value those businesses? But I do think it's very important for us to think about how we invest in those companies at this point in history. And that is something that we think deeply about. And we believe we should position portfolios to have enough exposure to companies that are at the forefront of what we think would just be unbelievable and dramatic change over the next decade. And that does require a lot of thought. It requires thoughtful investment and it's perhaps a slight change in approach than what we might have seen over prior decades.
Okay, interesting, Ian. Thanks for that. Look, you mentioned there some opportunities ahead, and I know you mentioned Nike and L'Oreal for adjusting to change, but I'm sure our audience today will be interested to hear, I suppose, do you have any specific opportunities that you might like to, I suppose, go into a little bit of further detail on?
Yeah, absolutely. Stock ideas. We always understandably get that question. You make it more tangible. What should we invest in? And I think clearly I can't get into giving specific recommendations on this call, and we'd be delighted to talk to individuals and clients separately afterwards. I think just to give you a sense of it, though, we do think in healthcare, just as healthcare is ready to be disrupted and changed, and we can see that across medical technology, genomics, and so on. And we do own a number of strategies that are, and indeed businesses that we think are positioned well for that. And renewable energy, another area that we've been allocating to for a number of years, and again, explicit strategies there. In terms of the big tech platform businesses, businesses like Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and so on seem curiously undervalued relative to their growth today. And whilst there are new technology businesses emerging over the past few years, a lot of what is going to happen can't happen without those businesses. And in terms of that point around new technology, I think, not to feel like I'm overstating it here, but there's likely trillions of market cap that will be created over the next decade. And thinking about how we allocate to specialists in these areas that allow us to capture that. We had Gary Robinson join us from Bailey Gifford on a call last year. And that's an example of how we're thinking about how we do this, how we can partner effectively with firms like Bailey Gifford to allow us to get exposure to some of these new and emerging technologies.
Thanks, Ian. Look, that sounds like there's a huge amount of opportunities out there. Dan, I might come to you. Despite the roller coaster of year we've just been through, with continued uncertainty around, markets have staged an incredible recovery since the March lows last year. I mean, surely this isn't sustainable. Are valuations go too far?
Catherine, I think it's, and good morning, everybody. I think it's perfectly natural people look around, take a walk around your hometown and see businesses shuttered, and then listen to the financial media and you hear about markets hitting all-time highs. And there's naturally a disconnect between the two. So I think it's reasonable that people wonder, how can this be happening? I think there are a number of ways of rationalizing it or of explaining it. Firstly, like characteristics of the pandemic economy have been, all businesses have been shuttered down. So those that have had other ways of reaching their customers as opposed to just physical in-store sales have been hugely beneficial. If you look around, what's been hit hardest, hospitality, physical retail, they're the businesses that we see as we walk around going about our daily lives. But it might give a disproportionate sense of the extent to which business has ground to a halt throughout the pandemic. Large businesses have benefited versus small businesses. And if we think about what we talk about when we're talking about listed stock exchanges, we're talking about large businesses. Even when we talk about small cap listed companies, we're still talking about companies that have hundreds of millions of market cap. So by any reasonable definition, they're all large businesses on stock exchanges. So there has been a grab of market share from those larger businesses that are represented in exchanges versus small companies. And somebody might reasonably say, how can there be market share to grab? Well, that's where I think the real critical factor comes into play. And that's been the extraordinary policy response that we've seen from governments and central banks around the world. Effectively, money has been put into people's pockets. They've spent it. And the companies that are disproportionately represented on listed exchanges have taken the lion's share of that consumption of revenue. So, these policy responses haven't been perfect, but they have more or less got money where it's needed to go. And I think a big mistake a lot of investors made last year was underappreciating the scope of that policy support that the global economy got. We had extraordinary situations where the disposable income in the US went up after the pandemic, after the lockdowns kicked in last spring, which is an incredible indication of how strong the fiscal support was in the US. So that money has been available. And largely speaking, consumption has still happened and commerce has been ongoing. I'd say it might be a better indication for people to look at their postman and look at their delivery people rather than looking at the businesses that are unfortunately still shuttered on the main street. Then there's another question that goes beyond just why markets might have recovered. And that brings the bubble point into question. I think bubble is a much abused term. Often we kind of facetiously say when we hear somebody crying bubble, we actually think they're just saying this is a bull market, which I've missed out on. There's a lot of people are pointing at various parts of the market that they consider to be evidence of widespread excess. But I think it's only pockets. And some of this, the headlines are taken very, very strongly out of context. So just recently, we had headlines saying we've record inflows into equity markets over the last few months. And that might indicate somebody reading that could easily think, okay, it looks like there's hell for leather. People are piling into equity markets and this is starting to look overheated. But if you actually step back and take that record inflow into context, all it has done is reverse about 20% of the record outflows that we've experienced over the last 3 or 4 years. So context is very important when we're reading headlines and hearing about things like record inflows. There are other, I suppose, examples of pockets of mania, which undoubtedly are not tethered to any rationality. You know, GameStop has got a lot of press coverage over the last few weeks. We've certain cryptocurrency assets that, you know, don't seem to have much utility. I'm not talking about Bitcoin here. Some of the more esoteric crypto assets that are going up by incredible amounts, I don't think they're tethered to anything rational. But I don't think we can look at pockets of things like GameStop and say, well, this is evidence that there is wide, broad speculative mania happening in the global equity market. You know, we have to look at valuation to come to a conclusion that there's a bubble. And you can find a valuation metric to suit any argument, as we know. We tend to like to use free cash flow as an indicator because it's less easy to manipulate free cash flow than it is to manipulate accounting earnings. So free cash flow, the amount a business has left over for discretionary spending after they've covered operational costs. And if you take the free cash flow of the global market, of all the companies in the global market, and you divide it by the market cap of those companies, you can get a free cash flow yield, which just like a rental yield on a property, we think that's quite a good indication of general market valuation. And at the moment, the free cash flow yield on the global market is 5.5%. So that's a 5.5% starting free cash flow yield, and that yield will grow. I find it very hard to call that bubble territory, and particularly in an environment where we've got zero to negative interest rates. People might say, okay, the global market might be in a bubble, but the US market is. Well, the S&P 500, the 500 biggest companies in the US, is on a 4% free cash flow yield. And if somebody wants to make a case that that's expensive, that's an absolutely legitimate point of view to have. There's a debate to be had about that. But I still don't think we can get to a territory where it's legitimate to call something like that a bubble. So we're very, very far away when we look at the actual, have a rational look at the valuations from, I think, being able to call what we're experiencing at the moment in global equity markets a bubble.
Okay, thanks, Daniel. 5.5% cash flow yield certainly sounds attractive compared to the cash rates out there. And we might take a look at what our audience felt about whether we are in a bubble or not. Okay, interesting. Split, I suppose, nearly 40% of you feel we are in a bubble, with only 24% thinking we're not. I don't know, Dan, if you have an additional comment to make in regards to that.
Yeah, it mightn't be very scientific, but I would think something you're unlikely to see in a real bubble is nearly 4 in 10 people thinking that they're in a bubble. Bubbles tend to happen when everyone loses the run of themselves, and there are very few people crying bubble. So it mightn't be very scientific, but that would be somewhat reassuring to me in terms of thinking we're nowhere near a bubble at this stage.
Thank you, Dan. Dan, you commented there on policy responses. And one message that we've been, I suppose, consistent with over the past 10 years is how we believe that interest rates will stay low for a very long time and how a low interest rate environment is positive for equity markets. Now, in order to do this, governments have been taking on significant levels of debt. So we asked you, the audience, whether you feel that this is unsustainable or not, and might take a look at what your response was. Are government debt levels unsustainable? And over 50% of you feel that they're not. That's quite interesting. Ian, I don't know if you have a view here. Surely, you know, somebody has to pay for this at some point. And I suppose, does that have a negative, ultimately have a negative effect on the economy?
I think some important consideration there. It's not necessarily true of all equity assets, because we do need to ask the question whether interest rates are low because growth is low. So we can't, I'm mindful of falling into the trap of having our cake and trying to eat it too, whereby we use very low discount rates and then we assume the same growth rates that we would have done previously. So I think there is some nuance there. And I think within the equity market, low interest rates, low growth are maybe telling us that there are parts of the market that are going to continue to be challenged, but those equity assets that can continue to grow it's rational that they would be more highly valued today. And indeed, those equity assets, if they continue to grow, could do quite well. In terms of the debt levels, debt levels have clearly increased materially. The narrative and that question that we have today is who is going to pay for it? And I think that's absolutely a valid question. But I think when answering that or reflecting on how we should answer that, I think we need to understand who owns that, whose debt burden is it? And effectively what we've seen is governments issue IOUs in their own currency. The Eurozone's a little different, but essentially the point is essentially the same, in order to fund and help people get through this crisis. So, and if it's the governments that essentially own this debt, then they can, it's within their gift to in effect inflate it away. Like the narrative now is very different to what it was in 08, 09, when after post-financial crisis, we talked about austerity, tightening our belts and all that and so on. There's no appetite for austerity now. No government is going to be elected on the platform of austerity. So, the answer to us seems very clear, in fact, that the debt levels are going to be inflated away over time. And that's not true, just kind of, hyperinflation is going to run away, anything like that. We just think the debt levels will be brought down to an extended period of governments being able to borrow below inflation. As long as the economy is growing above the rate of the interest rate that governments have to pay on the debt, then it'll fall over time. And the easiest way to do that is to support nominal growth and to support the economy to pursue policies that rise inflation a bit and just generally lead to higher economic activity. And I suppose, history tells us a lot about what the consequences of these things are. And we've spoken about this for some time now, but the most analogous period we would contend is the period after the World War II, when there was a big build-up in debt for another emergency, obviously a very different one. But what we saw after that was that the debt levels came down to more sustainable levels, and effectively through one very clear overt policy, governments being able to borrow below inflation, create the conditions where they can borrow below inflation for a long period of time. So to give you a stat to back that up, the after inflation interest rate from a US Treasury bill from 1946 to 1980 was minus 1.6%. It's easy to kind of throw these numbers out there and say, well, that what the meaningless, minus 1.6% for 30 odd years. You know, you can see the erosion of purchasing power for cash or treasury bills, near cash instruments, was very significant. And so it's not to say that we shouldn't hold cash in our portfolios, but we need to be eyes wide open, and that the tax that is going to pay for this is the negative return from for the pools of capital that are sitting in cash and government bonds. That is the tax. And you know, will this have a negative impact on the economy? I think there's the potential for increased volatility when debt levels are high, but not necessarily going to be negative given who owns the debt. You know, the consumer's in good shape today, corporates are generally in good shape today. So I'm not overly concerned about that. I think there might be some risk that there's a temptation to pursue policies that are more inflationary and to bring those debt levels down quicker. That's something I think that we should be mindful of, conscious of. And again, that brings me back to the conclusion, really, that you know, cash in all its forms, which is a valid thing to hold and should be held in portfolios, but will almost certainly lose value versus real assets or companies with real earning streams over the next decade. To us, that just seems incredibly clear.
Thanks, Ian. Dan, I might go over to you again now. The experience of the last 12 months has obviously been really tough on everyone in different ways. Has your, I suppose, outlook as chair of the Portfolio Construction Committee, has your outlook changed? And I suppose, have you made any changes in response to your outlook?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. We've spoken many times over the years that we don't think we've any value to add in terms of making short-term market predictions. And I think 2020 is probably a brilliant example of the folly of making short-term calls. I think back to reading all the big year ahead 2020 pieces in late 2019, and one word that wasn't mentioned was coronavirus. There was no mention of the pandemic. And of course, that was by far and away the dominant factor throughout the year. So we don't play the short-term game, and short-term influences would rarely affect our long-term outlook. But the nature of the pandemic actually, if anything, has made our long-term views even more firmly in place than they were before the pandemic. As Ian touched on, we're looking to position clients from a portfolio construction point of view, position clients to benefit from the revolutionary impact of the digitalization of the global economy. You know, we think the disruptors and the disrupted will have very, very different outcomes from an investment perspective. So we want to ensure that we're tilting our clients' portfolios towards that the beneficiaries of this digitalization of the global economy. And I think that's really, really important that we get those portfolio construction decisions right. And as I said, the fact that we've had an acceleration of these trends, and Ian touched on it as well in his previous answer, that we've had these trends accelerating. So we believe that we're somewhat vindicated that the validity of our overall thesis is not just intact, but we're seeing quicker proof that this is happening than we would have expected. Ian mentioned Satya Nadella from Microsoft. We've seen dozens and dozens of CFOs, CEOs say the exact same thing, that the kind of revenue targets that they had for going out to 2025, 2026, in many cases, they hit those targets in Q2 of 2020, the minute the lockdowns hit. So in general, we feel that there's been some confirmation of our overall view of how we need to position clients. And then maybe in practical terms, what have we done? Well, in March, we wrote a lot about the opportunity that we thought the panic-driven sell-off was affording to investors. We thought that was there were signs of outright irrational panic-driven selling, and that presented an opportunity. In terms of specific sectors, what have we been investing in? You know, clients often ask about renewable energy. It's a really interesting topic. You know, we own a Schroder Energy Transition Fund, which we think is a really smart way to play the inevitable transition from kind of carbon-based energy to a cleaner, more renewable future.
See what our audience felt about that outlook. And I'm interesting. Your message is obviously very clear, Daniel. Has the experience of the last 12 months changed your investment view? And over 60% of you feel that it hasn't, which is quite interesting. One of the questions, we got a few questions around, Dan, and I might go back to you again on this, is, I suppose, how often do you review those kind of decisions around, mixing up the portfolio, construction of the portfolios?
Yeah, we never stop reviewing. That's our job description, myself and Ian. And at Bruin, we think analysis, an ongoing analysis, is a full-time job. So that's why we have teams of specialists, analysts, and strategists. And we're tasked with making sure that not only are we completely on top of all the investments that we put in client portfolios, but we're also, we have the manpower and the resources to keep scanning for attractive opportunities as they may arise over time.
Interesting. And then I suppose there's obviously a huge cohort of people out there who maybe just aren't comfortable with taking on, I suppose, the volatility that investing in equities brings. Are there any alternatives to cash over there? You know, not super returns, just anything that's in any way reflects kind of the feeling that you would have from holding cash.
Yeah, I'm going to have a very unsatisfactory answer to this. There isn't a panacea. And we were talking about, I mentioned bubble being a much abused term. I think cash alternative is a much abused term to a very dangerous extent. You know, the things that I've seen over the years and we've seen described as cash alternatives are quite frightening, things like equity linked structured products and the likes. So we need to be very careful when we're talking to clients that in particular are looking for an alternative home for something that would otherwise have probably stayed on deposit, earning what we've become used to being reasonable deposit returns over time. What we want to avoid is our clients having excessive amounts of cash on deposit for long periods, because while this might feel prudent, it might feel like it's a safe thing to do, it's actually illusory. It gives an illusion of safety. The cash deposit won't experience the ups and downs of an invested asset. But over time, at these current levels of interest rates, and particularly when you factor in inflation and you get very deeply negative real rates for a very long time, sitting with excessive amounts of cash on deposit are in very, very low risk government debt is a recipe for guaranteeing the loss of purchasing power. So our solution to that is to take a few reasonably straightforward steps. And the first thing is always have that rainy day fund set aside, have an amount of cash that is there for any unforeseen expenses that might have to occur over the coming, say, 2 or 3 years. And also a little bit of surplus on top of that to make sure that you're not solely relying on employment income or pension income, that there's a nice buffer there. And that buffer creates the ability to then look at the rest of your overall balance sheet, your overall wealth, and say, well, for the rest of this, what can I do to protect against the loss of purchasing power, but without taking on too much risk? And the answer really is to extend our time horizon. Because the truth is, the only assets that will protect purchasing power over time will also experience volatility in the short run. So we need to think about extending a time horizon to a few years, which means we can deal with volatility and we have that rainy day fund set aside in the meantime. And then make sure that when we do invest, we do it in a very diversified manner and we do it going into high quality investment portfolios. And a high quality diversified portfolio, while it will experience short-term volatility, it will also recover. And given time, that is the only responsible way to protect purchasing power over time. And as I said at the outset, that might sound somewhat disappointing, but it's the truth. And I think anybody saying that there is a zero risk solution that will provide a positive after inflation return, to put it politely, they're not being forthright.
Thank you, Dan. There's clearly opportunities out there. Valuations are clearly, you know, reasonable with, you know, 5.5% cash flow yields, but people have obviously done very well the last few years. Is there an argument, and we're certainly getting questions on this a fair bit, to kind of, I suppose, bank those profits from the last few years and buy again if and when the market pulls back?
Yeah.
Ian, I might go to you.
Sorry, I'm jumping ahead there, apologies. Yes, I think that's a very natural question to ask, given the rate of appreciation in markets since last March. And in fact, I've just written a note about this, which we will be sending out to clients tomorrow. Important to remember that, you know, back in March, equity markets were at a level of absolute panic. It was one of the biggest panics in market history. The level of panic only seen during the financial crisis and during the Great Depression. So only three times it's been that severe. So therefore, just to contextualize the recovery, and world equity markets in euro terms have only just gone past the high from the start of last year. So it's not really a runaway market at all. But at the same time, appreciate that the pace of gains since March has been high. So it would be, you know, understandable where people might ask the question whether, particularly if during 2020 it felt very uncomfortable, being invested during that volatility, whether they want to re-examine their own asset allocation, with how they should be positioned. But, you know, thinking, you know, for the longer term investors who are comfortable with equities and perhaps time these things, well, you know, when we look at the what could potentially catalyze a significant correction, well, it's not likely to be a recession because we're just coming out of one, and not likely to be central bank interest rate increases because they've told us that they're going to let the economy run hot effectively. Perhaps an unforeseen event, but in their very nature unforeseen. And valuation, well, Dan has already addressed that earlier in terms of the prevailing valuation of the equity market today. Now, to be clear, we absolutely will see a correction at some point. That's guaranteed, but it may well be from a higher level. And one thing that I think is becoming apparent in markets at the moment, actually, is we get an increasing sense that we might be witnessing an asset allocation shift. The big pools of capital in the world that want to or need to get 4, 5, 6% returns moving away from bonds and equities. I think we're starting to see that. So if that is happening, that will clearly limit the extent of a correction we might see. I often, when I'm asked this question, I do go back to Peter Lynch, the famous investor who remarked that you know, far more money has been lost by investors preparing for corrections or trying to anticipate corrections than has been lost in corrections themselves. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. You know, trying to time these things is incredibly difficult. I do think, you know, pessimism does sound smarter. You know, optimism often sounds naive, but we would maybe, you know, respond to that. You know, pragmatic optimists are those who make money and make returns for clients. So I think, you know, we are of the view that we're in a bull market, and trying to time exit and entry points in that market is unlikely to be successful. You know, I think everyone needs to re-examine and look at their own asset allocation to make sure they're comfortable, they have a plan that they can stick to. But for the long-term investors, the only rationale for selling would be to try and buy back in cheaper. And again, history just tells us that that's incredibly difficult. And that underlying point that, you know, we are in a bull market, so the path of least resistance is likely to be higher.
Okay, thanks, Ian. And I suppose for those investors who may not have ever invested before, they're just used to leaving their money on deposit. I mean, for the new investor, is it the same message? Do you just, I suppose, get on the investment journey now? Ian, I might come back to you again on that.
Yeah, thank you, Catherine. That's a great question because it's always a challenge. Markets perform quite strongly to invest for the first time. I think the answer there, you know, and certainly the answer has to be the same. You have to be consistent if you look at valuations today. And we're long-term investors. We're not investing for the short term. But we can understand that sometimes it can be uncomfortable for people. So, you know, on a case-by-case basis, we'd have that discussion. But we would certainly encourage people to make a start and think about what their long-term plan is.
Great. Thank you, Ian. Some really insightful pieces of information there from both of you guys. I suppose we are talking about looking ahead to 2021. So I might go to both of you to get, I suppose, a key message that you would both like to convey. And Ian, I feel like I'm picking on you, but I'll go back to you first on this one.
Not at all. I deserve to be picked on after my tech issues. And ironically, I'm going to answer, but the one thing that really comes to mind is how to capture the change that we're seeing in the economy, how to capture technological innovation change in a way that's tolerable. I'll come back to that. I think we are in the foothills of one of the biggest technological revolutions in history. I think over the next decade, multiple sectors, multiple industries, many incumbent businesses are going to be challenged, utterly challenged. I think what we're seeing is potentially a 10 times reduction in costs and of delivering new technology across industries. And you think how transformative that's going to be. You know, having listened to a recent call with ASML, one of the critical companies in the semiconductor value chain, you know, suggestion that computing power might increase by 60-fold over the next decade. Just think about the implications of that. It's almost impossible to get your head around. So we think, notwithstanding in the very short term, there might be some silliness in terms of certain certain parts of the market that look expensive. I think if we stand back, I think we can reflect that there's just going to just be enormous change over the next decade. And it's incumbent on us, you know, look, we are conservative investors. We want to protect, we want to grow capital judiciously. And we know capital has been hard earned and we don't want to lose it. Don't lose money, rule number one, and rule number two, as per Warren Buffett. And we want to protect that capital. But at the same point, at this point in history, I think we need to think a little differently about how we do that and to have exposure to think about how we invest in technology, but in a way that doesn't shake us out, because, you know, there will be periods where, you know, technology businesses, to use an oversimplified term, but they can go through enormous volatility, 30, 40% falls, and that's just uncomfortable. And the risk is that we could get shaken out and not stick to a plan. So how we invest in technological change, innovation, in a way within a portfolio that allows us and allows our investors to stay on our long-term plan, you know, is something that exercises us enormously and is one of the key messages I would like to convey.
Dan, I might go to you very quickly on this. I'm conscious there's a lot of questions that have come in. We have managed to cover some of them. I know we haven't covered them all, but as I said earlier on in the presentation, we will get to you after the event. So Dan, quick view from yourself looking ahead into 2021.
Yeah, 2021 to me, looking ahead means learning the lessons that we've just been exposed to. So I think 2020 was a vindication of kind of personalized investment service and long-term planning. I think people should focus on personal goals instead of getting fixated by arbitrary benchmarks. What are you trying to achieve? I often think about financial journalist Jason Zweig was interviewing a load of wealthy US retirees in Boca Raton, the exclusive retirement community in Florida. And he asked them if he thought that over the course of their careers that their investments beat the market or not. And a lot of them said yes. Some of them said no. Most of them said don't know. But one man said, I don't care if I beat the market. All I know is my investments did enough for me to retire to Boca Raton. And I think that's a fantastic philosophy for individual investors to have on their path to retirement. And really, ultimately, that's everybody is trying to make sure that they can fund the lifestyle that they think they're accustomed to and they deserve in their retirement. So last year, an investor without a coherent plan and an advisor with whom they could speak to during the turmoil in March was much more likely to make the classic mistakes and abandon a sensible long-term plan. So at Brew & Dauphin, what we really want to do is make sure that we're having an ongoing conversation with clients, that it's building up understanding and trust over time. And I think if you're not having a rolling conversation with your investment advisor, then long-term success is unlikely. So in a nutshell, the outlook for us is to make sure that we continue to offer the kind of service and the level of service that makes sure our clients are going to achieve their long-term goals over time.
Thank you, Dan. Guys, that is all the time we have for today. So I would just like to take the opportunity to thank both Ian and Dan for their insights. And most importantly, thank you for you guys for taking the time to listen today.
We really hope you enjoy the session. And if there's any questions that come out of it, please do just get in touch.